Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit today, maybe tomorrow, about Mechiras Chametz and controversy, and the general issue of controversy surrounding Mechiras Chametz, and maybe we'll have an opportunity tomorrow also to compare and contrast with the Hetzer Mechira. And I'd like to talk generally today about the whole controversy that relates to Mechiras Chametz and some points of how to relate to it. It is controversial, although not at all as controversial as Hetzer Mechira, as we'll talk about separately. But Mechiras Chametz, Bizmanenu, has found much more wide acceptance, not at all 100%, and there certainly are many who are somewhere in between, in that they accept Mechiras Chametz only for Dinim Derabanan, and not for Dinim Deraisa, only for Chametz that might be termed as a prohibition of Derabanan, at least as far as ownership, but actual Chametz Gomer, bread, and things like that, they won't sell, and there are various explanations for why that is. And there are many who don't take that approach and who sell Chametz Gomer also. So I'd like to discuss first today a way to approach that controversy and why there may be room to understand those who have fully embraced Mechiras Chametz as a viable approach despite the controversy. There's a lot of history behind it. There's a lot of both lumdus and analysis behind it. And also there are a lot of conflicting premises and foundations. You'll see that we're just only going to talk very briefly, but there's extensive literature about it, and not everyone is on the same page, literally. You know, they're not all necessarily coming from the same hanachos, the same presumptions, and that's a major part of the issue. So, to speak broadly about it, the issue that many of us have with something like Mechiras Chametz, and it can be grouped with many other things, and we'll compare it maybe tomorrow with the Hetzer Mechira, is that there are certain, it's very hard to find the right word, because any word you choose a little bit prejudges the conversation, but they seem like devices, mechanisms, workarounds, which already starts to get a little bit more judgmental.
Haramos,
so in the Batsa Bagetu, the Hebrew word becomes very loaded. So first, even just an English word or a Hebrew word, both of them are already very prejudicial. And whatever word that you pick becomes very, very difficult to separate that out from whatever conclusion you're going to come to. But the issue is that, for a serious lack of a better term, we'll call it a mechanism or an approach, that there are various mechanisms that are utilized in halacha that have gained varying degrees of controversy, and the varying degrees is a part of what we are, part of what we're interested in here. That, why some more so, why some less so, and various points in between. But the question of how to look at these things, to look at these different ways of addressing what might be a halachic challenge, what may not be so much of a halachic challenge, depending on the circumstance, and why some of them are more accepted, why some of them are less accepted. So when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, so there is a general brouhaha that surrounds it. And if you think about it, it kind of relates to two general types of concerns, which may converge, but they're really separate. And it's helpful maybe just to identify them before thinking about what the proponents or the opponents have said. So on the one hand, there is a concern that it's just not what the Torah is looking for, that if the Torah gives us a mitzvah or an iser, so then we should be addressing it head on. And that to have some way of avoiding it is somehow to abdicate our religious responsibility. Yes, sir.
Is that a critique in terms of the letter of the law, or a critique in terms of the
spirit
of the law?
So we'll see. There's so many details and nuances that you probably want to hold off on some of the questions. But you'll see that that's going to play out in all different ways. But in general, the idea that somehow, even if you could technically satisfy, let's say, the letter of the law, but that there is, we'll call it for now, a spirit of the law consideration, that you are evading the Ratzon HaTorah. The Torah gave us a rule, And maybe we have or haven't, but maybe we have successfully found a way to not be subject to that rule, but it is not what the Torah is really asking for. And therefore, that is essentially wrong. The second type of objection is that the process is essentially fraudulent. Maybe that's too strong a term. For others, it's not strong enough of a term, but that the process is somehow insincere, that whatever is being purported to take place is actually not really happening, and the whole thing is a sham. So that has also played a prominent role in the machlokas. And what we'll also see is that is very subject to details and to questions on the ground of how it's actually played out. So that's something that we also need to pay attention to. So just to try to sketch out a little bit of the landscape, and what you'll see here is that it gets a little hard to follow because a lot of the arguments become separated from their original authors. And then that becomes tricky to try to keep connected to its original intent, and it may not necessarily matter so much. So we'll try to take a look at that a little bit. But one of the major voices in the whole debate, specifically about Mechiras Chametz, and also about these approaches as a whole, was the Bechor Shor, not the Rishon, the Bechor Shor, but the one who lived in the 1700s, Alexander Shor, who wrote a sefer called Bechor Shor, also a sefer called Tevuah Shor, so he's referred to when he's quoted, as he is extensively on this topic, by both names. Some references to the Bechor Shor, his sefer on Shas, which is where this comment really appears, or also is referred to as the Tevuah Shor, the name of his other sefer. And it also goes, his statement has tremendous weight and tremendous significance in the conversation about Haramos in general. So Haramos is also a very tricky and possibly judgmental term. And even just to try to analyze the meaning and the usage of the word Haramos will take us quite a long time. It has implications for all kinds of areas of Torah, both of the narrative of Torah and also the philosophy of the Torah and the halachic application of Torah. It's quite a lot to say. But it's also a part of the problem that you have to figure out whether the word harama, what exactly the translation is a part of the problem. For now, let's say it's a way of taking a different path. It's as neutral as way we could say it. It's a way of taking a different route around something. Does it mean that it is necessarily negative or wrong in some way? Very unclear if every usage is the same. And it's also very unclear what is called that and what isn't. So you're kind of very often in a circular argument because you have to figure out whether what you're talking about is a harama. And if it is that necessarily bad? What necessarily are the consequences of calling something a harama? So that's why trying to work your way through the literature can be very, very challenging, and especially on this topic. And the Bechor Shor played a major part in that. It was a major part of that whole discussion. So the Bechor Shor, essentially, in his comments to Maseches Pesachim and Daf Kof Aleph, where there the Mishnah... the Mishnah does talk about selling chametz to a non-Jew as a way of accomplishing tashbisu. But that's not the sale that we're familiar with. That is selling chametz and saying goodbye to it forever. So that doesn't engender the controversy that we have nowadays, which is more premised on a tosefta, which maybe you had a chance to take a look at this morning. And we'll go into more detail about this. But to work a little bit backwards chronologically, so the Bechor Shor maintained a few premises, and the controversy that surrounds him has to also realize that there are at least three identifiable points in his statement. And when you argue or agree with the Bechor Shor, it could be for any of the three reasons. You might argue on one or more of his premises. So what are his three premises? That harama is only effective or permissible, that itself is a question. Do we mean that it only works or that it's only something that we would tolerate? So I'll fudge that for a second. Say haramos can only be used for dinim derabanan, not for dinim and haTorah. That's one premise. The second premise is that mechiras chametz is a harama. So therefore, A plus B, mechiras chametz should only be used for situations that are derabanan. Now here, there's a little bit more complexity, because I mentioned before that there are many who have that practice in their personal lives. It's a very common practice to only use mechiras chametz for dinim derabanan, but that's not actually what the Bechor Shor is describing, because he then goes on to understand that our mechiras chametz today, in his formulation, actually only is dealing with drabanas. So what he is describing, he would actually allow selling bread, which is different than the approach we mentioned before. So how could you call that a drabanan? Probably should hold off on the question, because there'll be so many details that we'll see if it has. So how could that be dealt with? How could that be called a drabanan? We all know that that's clearly stated in HaTorah, Ba'ira, Ba'imatze, we're not allowed to have bread on Pesach in our possession. So to that he explains that's because of bittul. Because the Gemara has that line that bittul is effective on a level in HaTorah to knock things down to a drabana. Now that is said in a slightly different context, right? The Gemara says that in the context of explaining Bedikas Chametz, that Bedikas Chametz is only necessary on a level midrabanan because it is dealt with by Bittul, that because of Mavata L'Chametz, since that addresses Ba'yira Ba'yimatze on a Daraisa level, so what's left is only an issue drabanan, and that's why Bedikas Chametz is only necessary on a level midrabanan. But here he's utilizing it very differently to say that selling chametz is effective because it is only necessary midrabanan because of bittul. That is a very tricky premise. Why is that such a tricky premise? As many objected, some agreed, but many objected. Right?
What's selling chametz, which you don't like accepting anything,
right? Essentially. Right. So I think what you're saying, just to look more clearly, is that it's not the same chametz. That the chametz are mevatel and the chametz you're selling, really two separate packages of chametz. That if you really believe the chametz is nothing, as you declare in the bittul, so then how could you sell it? And if you're selling it, how could you be mevatel it? It's contradictory, presumably. The Kadjik Lavarov, Kedarka Bekaidish, has a very creative way of explaining how you could make the two work together. But on the surface, it seems problematic. That it seems like what we really mean is that when we sell chametz, so we're selling different chametz. So the chametz that we sell is the chametz that we know about and we plan on reuniting with after Pesach, which is where a lot of the controversy comes from. And the chametz that we're mevatel is the chametz that's under the couch that we couldn't find and we don't know about, and that's where mevatel. It happens to be a big machlokas rishonim, maybe we'll come back to this, whether bittul works on chametz yadua or not. But at least in practice, the chametz that we are mevatel is ideally the chametz that we don't know about, don't plan on ever seeing again, and that's what we are assigning bittul to. So the chametz that we're selling is very difficult to say that's included in the bittul for all kinds of reasons. So presumably, if you are following this whole mahaluch of the Bechor Shor, that it only works for din derabanan, so then it's hard to say that our mechiras chametz of bread should work, even though he would allow it on the surface. So that's a big machlokas, how to address that part of it, and there's a pretty extensive literature about that. Now, there's a lot to figure out about all of this, and like I said, you could argue on any one of the three premises. You could argue on his premise that haramos are only tolerated or effective or tolerated, that we're not clear on, but only workable for dinam d'rabanan, that itself is a big question. The question of whether mechiras chametz should be categorized as such a harama is hotly debated. And this premise that you're only dealing with rabbanans because you've knocked it down through a bittul is also hotly debated, and is not necessarily the reason that many have distinction in their practice today, and others accept the Bechor Shor but have a different explanation, like Rishterbach in many of his Chuvas says a different way to read our issue of Bayura Bayimatsi today is largely rabbinic, not because of his approach. And that's a major discussion. So as we noted, a lot of the discussion becomes separated from the original author, which makes it a little bit complicated. And that's something that we'll have to see a question about that.
Yeah, I mean, could it be that, like, on a biblical plane, you are being mevatel, like, midoraisa, mm-hmm. but your hands are, like, kind of tied because, like, midorabanan, you have to sell it, but you're not... The only reason why you're selling it isn't because your relationship to it has changed, but because, like, the Rabbanan require you to not just do Bittul.
But the question is that they actually require you to sell it, and they could require you to get rid of it and be mevatel it. So what's interesting is, though, in terms of the requirement, so just to add a little bit more confusion into the mix, so the Shtei Chemed, who, you know, Shtei Chemed is a sefer which has a tremendous bikiyas in it, he has a lot to say. He collected from everywhere, and he has an essay. It's not so long, but it's very dense in terms of citations in his essay, where he quotes many who raise this objection that we just noted, that you can't really maintain that it's all the Rabbanan because of Bithel, because that's going to not really hold up. But he also says that he thinks that everyone's making a mistake in citing the Bechor Shor, because he thinks that the Bechor Shor himself didn't conclude that way. That the Bechor Shor himself doesn't actually stick with this. And that's a major point. So, just to try to get it out, first of all, the context, what the Bechor Shor is talking about. So, since he would allow our selling of bread, for example, so what was the whole fuss about? So, what he was upset about was a different practice. And this was also subject to a lot of controversy. He was upset that people were selling their animals to non-Jews over the course of Pesach. And then what would happen is the non-Jews would feed their animals bread, would feed their animals chametz over the course of Pesach. So because he didn't think that sale was genuine, so he saw that as benefiting from chametz over the course of Pesach, which is an issur d'oraisa. So because that's an issur d'oraisa and the sale he did not believe was genuine, so he felt that that was inappropriate and wrong and ineffective. Yeah.
They sold the chametz that was going to...
They didn't sell the chametz. That's the other thing. They sold the animals. Right? They sold the animals to non-Jews. So that, which we do that also partially. We sell animals too over Pesach for reasons of fine, because it's very hard some for certain animals to find non-chametz feed. But these people who had farms and had all kinds of extensive ownership of animals, so they would sell the animals. And then the temporary, I'm saying temporary only de facto, not necessarily that was the plan, but who ultimately established as temporary owners of the animals, would be feeding chametz to the animals. And since the Bechor Shor felt that the sale was not real, so therefore he felt that really the Jews still owned these animals over the course of the time, and they were benefiting from this chametz that's being fed to them, so Hanah of Chametz is an Issur Min HaTorah, and this Mechira does not do anything for that, because it's an Issur Min HaTorah, and that's no good. But the sale of our own Chametz, okay, that he wasn't so bothered by, because that he felt was knocked down to a Drabbanan by the Bittul. So what the Shtei Chemed points out is that if you look at his language, it doesn't sound like at the end that he actually even uses only that to explain Mechira of Chametz itself, because there he says, maybe it's a little similar to what Shmuel was getting at before, that when it comes to the Chametz itself, he felt, okay, the Chametz that they really feel they need to maintain, so that they're just not going to have any real choice, because either they have to destroy it or sell it with complete commitment. So then, okay, they sell that and they mean it, and they really are going to sell it. But when it comes to the animals, they don't need to, and they don't mean it, and he's still against that. But as far as the chametz, so that it could be they actually are doing in a genuine way. So that is an interesting detail, which Stechemet is saying everyone seems to be missing the way he assesses it. That the objection of the Bechor Shor is really to the process, and that even he could acknowledge that for the Chametz itself, maybe our process actually is more genuine. And that that last line kind of got missed, but that he wasn't really applying his objection or his assessment of Mechiras Chametz as a Harama to Mechiras Chametz as a whole. But that many did, and take it kind of separate from the author, take that Mechiras Chametz as a Harama, and that Harama is always a problem when dealing with any Din D'Oraisa, etc., etc. Now, yeah?
I thought that the Bechor Shor was trying to address the concern of it being you're avoiding like your religious responsibility.
So that's a good question. So it doesn't sound like it. Now I think others do, and we'll see. We'll try to get to that in the next few minutes. But it's not the thrust of his objection. I think the thrust of his objection is that the process is fake, and therefore it's not effective on a level of Minotaur. There's a Gemara that sounds like that. Without getting into the details of the Gemara, maybe I should have put it on the list. I could put it on for tomorrow. But he's based on a Gemara which has a line that seems to draw such a distinction. And that Gemara, which many others object to the Bechor Shor because they think the Gemara is talking about a completely not comparable case, because it's talking about doing something under a pretext, essentially, and I'm sorry for being vague, you can look at the Gemara later, but essentially, that's the Bechor Shor's understanding. He thinks that Mechiras Chametz, at least in the case of the animals, or maybe in all of it, is a pretext, that it's not really happening, that there isn't real commitment to the sale, and therefore it's not genuine.
I don't understand why then it would be okay to do like a quote-unquote fake sale with Darabana.
I agree with you.
It works for Dura-Risa's. Whenever I give somebody my lulav to borrow, it's a matana manas lahasi.
Let's try to address as much of that as possible in the time that we have. The question is a legitimate one. I share your discomfort, you know, certainly as far as that if there's something inherently deficient, so then we shouldn't be comfortable on a level with the Rabbanan either. And I think that's a part of the reason you find some of the objection. Now, that's something we'll have to try to address, but essentially that's the thrust of it. It sounds like it's based on a Gemara in a different context and is what you could respond to it. But essentially it seems to be that to boil down the Bechor Shor's position as accurately within his own words, before we divorce it from the author, as part of the issue, but to boil down what his actual position is that he believes the process to be insincere. He believes the sale to be not genuine. He points to certain elements, such as the seller not being somebody who's usually selling things like this, the buyer not being somebody who usually buy things like this, usually not being somebody who is in a financial position to actually pay for the chametz, or I guess especially in what he was talking about, the animals themselves, presumably that's much more expensive, and that the buyer is not necessarily in a position to do that. So for all those reasons, he sees this process as illegitimate, and therefore only effective on a rabbinic level, but the sale of actual chametz itself, he believed he was not objecting to, ostensibly because he believes that only to be necessary on a level with Rabbanan. Many didn't agree with that premise at all. And there's a possibility, as the Stechem is pointing out, that maybe even the Bechor Shor would be okay with Chametz even on a level Minat Torah, because there he thinks the process maybe could have been more sincere than the selling of the animals. That's essentially just to try to summarize as accurately as I think we can the actual position of the Bechor Shor himself. Now, we could explain a distinction, if you want to hold on to a distinction between Daraisas and Drabanans, which was hotly debated in later sources. So you could take a different reason for such a distinction, and you'll see that here we are very much divorcing the content from the author, and I'll explain more in a minute. But if we want to speak abstractly and take away from the original Mechabrim, so you could say a completely different approach. And you could say, like we were alluding to before, that what if the objection is not about the process, but is just about the issue of evading religious responsibility. And it's an issue that you are not really complying with the spirit of the law. That even if you are in compliance with the letter of the law, that even if we do believe that you have technically satisfied the rules on paper, but you are not in fulfillment of the spirit of the Ratzon HaTorah, and that's the problem. Let's say if we were to assume that's the issue with whatever you want to call workarounds in general. So if that's the issue, so is there a more fundamental way to be machalic between Daraisas and Drabanans without the approach that I think we're understandably uncomfortable with a few minutes ago in saying that, well, we take Dinam and HaTorah more seriously, so then we got to be more straightforward, and Dinam Drabanan we're less scared about, so we're more comfortable, so to speak, playing games. So can we take a more fundamental approach? I think, yes, you want to suggest one?
I mean, why would it even be a problem in a Torah? I guess I said this earlier, so I'm sort of repeating myself. On the first day of Sukkot, people do the...
Yeah, that's coming from a separate angle. I'm going to cut you off just in the interest of time, because that's coming from a different direction, so we'll come back to that point. I apologize, I'm afraid that we won't have time to finish that point just yet. Mm-hmm. But we'll come back to it, God willing. So let me try to address this. So I think that you could say that you could come at it more fundamentally, because it probably should make us feel uncomfortable just to say that we take Darabanans less seriously than Daraisas. Don't think that's the only way to look at it. But if we do feel that the issue is that we're fulfilling the letter of the law but not the spirit of the law, there is a case to be made that there is a distinction here between rabbinic law and Torah law. Because when it comes to Torah law, so clearly we have letter of the law, and we also have spirit of the law behind it. When it comes to Dinam Darabanan, so there is a big approach within the Achronim, which we've spoken about in the past, most commonly associated with the author of the Nesivos HaMishpat, in that sefer, Nesivos HaMishpat primarily, where he seems to maintain that there's a distinction between Daraisas and Darabanans in terms of their purpose. And that Daraisas have fundamental meaning to them, is what you call a Isser Chefza. If we're dealing with Yisurim, there's something inherent in the item. While Darabanans are characterized more as not rebelling against Chazal, as an Isser Merit. You're not allowed to rebel. So if that's true, it may be arguable that regarding Dinam Darabanan, there is no spirit of the law. The spirit of the law is compliance. So as long as you are compliant, you are in fulfillment of the spirit of listening to Dinam Drabbanan. The whole gather is not being married, and as long as they're not being married, as long as you are in fulfillment of the letter of the law, that is the spirit of the law. So that may be a more fundamental way to be machalic between Daraisas and Drabbanans, because if the issue is we don't want to evade the spirit of the law, then maybe when it comes to Darabanans, we're not evading the spirit of the law because we're in compliance. That's all it takes to be in fulfillment of the spirit of the law of Dinam Darabanan. So I think that's a valid approach. But again, we are divorcing it from both authors in this case, because in terms of the Bechor Shor, it's not the explanation that he's using. And in terms of the Nesivos, he wouldn't agree either, because the Nesivos doesn't agree there is a distinction between the Daraisas and the Rabbanans. Because on this whole issue about the Bechor Shor's position, so there's a whole list of advocates of either side and among the Achronim, but probably top of the list of the opponents, top of the list of the other team, is the Nesivos. The author of the Nesivos, in many of his farim, primarily is Mekor Chaim, where he talks about the Hilchos Pesach. He also says a tshuva about this in the Sefer Nachlas Yaakov. From a number of his writings, so the Nesivos is considered one of the most prominent disputants of the Bechor Shor on this point. So he himself did not necessarily subscribe to this distinction. And the Bechor Shor did not explain the distinction this way. So the Sfar that I'm just saying, basically about combining the Bechor Shor and the Nesivos, neither of those authors themselves actually said, but to separate it from the original authorship, it's probably a valid question.
Way, what was his objection to Mechir HaChametz then?
So he didn't, the Nesivos didn't object to Mechir HaChametz. And he was arguing on the Bechor Shor completely. He didn't object to Mechir HaChametz. But he didn't accept the whole distinction between Daraisas and Rabbanans, and he didn't think that selling animals was a problem. He took him on that level. You know, there was a whole back and forth about it. But I'm saying, so he wouldn't necessarily have to have come on to this Lamdas, but within his position, which is a whole shelf of Svarim to begin with, but within that position, there is what to discuss. So, just to question about
that. He didn't accept the difference between Derabana and Derabaisas in regards to Mechir Chametz, or?
Yeah, in general, that he didn't think that there was a rule.
What does he do with his, like, his Svarah?
No, so I'm saying as far, I think, is a way to make such a distinction logical. You don't have to say it, but I think you could logically follow such an approach. If there was such a distinction, you could explain it this way. You don't have to believe there is such a distinction.
But ultimately, he himself rejects
it. He himself doesn't make this distinction. No, he doesn't address it, but I'm saying he doesn't subscribe to the distinction. Okay. But if one wanted to subscribe to the distinction, you could explain it this way. So that's as far as that's concerned, that's something to consider. Now, what's also important to appreciate is that the whole issue of Harama and Mechiras Chametz, which maybe you had a chance to see this morning, was taken on already by the Rishonim. And there also you find a lot of very interesting things. And that essentially our contemporary Mechiras Chametz, so it's not really based on what the Mishnah says about selling it to a non-Jew, because that's talking about selling it permanently, but it's closer to a Tosefta. That's a Tosefta, which I presumably saw. A Tosefta talks about somebody's traveling on a boat, and all of a sudden Pesach happens, right? It's more believable. I mean, as we know, nowadays also travel can be unpredictable, but certainly Bizmanehem and boats, and you could find your plans changing very radically at any moment. So you find yourself on a boat with all of your chametz, and you need to know what to do. Let's assume maybe your parnassah is tied into the chametz, but maybe not. But you don't know what to do with the chametz, so you're not ready to throw it over the side of the boat. So the Tosefta says you can make an arrangement with a non-Jewish fellow traveler and transfer it to him, and then you could reunite with the chametz after Pesach. So that seems to be a valid approach, which is closer to what we do today. However, is it close enough? So then that is hotly debated, because what we do today is planned and is set into the schedule months in advance, and it sounds like from the Tosefta like this was something that just happened and that it was once in a while. Who knows how necessary it was for his parnasa? So the idea that it's done so regularly is hotly debated. Very possibly. Yeah, very possibly. Very possibly. It's all a part of the debate. Now, what's particularly striking here is that the Rishonim discuss the issue of Harama explicitly here. So from the Bechor Shor on, there's a whole issue of is Mechiras Chametz a Harama or not. But this issue was discussed already by the Rishonim, and maybe even going back to the Tosefta itself. That's a question. Because as the Beis Yosef notes, that there is a clause that's discussed here that you can do this, you can transfer the chametz to a non-Jew, and the clause is ubilvad shelo yarim, as long as it's not a harama. Now, one major complication, in case we don't have enough so far, is that it's not clear where that phrase comes from, because some quote it from the Bahag, the Beis Yosef quotes it from the Bahag, and Rabbi Yerucham does. But it's also clear from some other Rishonim that they had a different girsa in the Tosefta. So whether that phrase comes from the Tosefta itself or whether it was brought up in Rishonim, it's a little unclear. But somehow this enters the mix that you can do this plan as long as it's not a harama. So the issue already brought up there that this can be done, but no haramas. So here, the Beis Yosef expresses, maybe you had a chance to see the Beis Yosef on the list, Beis Yosef says, what does that mean? He says, the whole thing is a harama, yet we're saying, do it. So apparently it's okay, despite being a harama. So we'll have to expand on this in a second, but you see, it seems like, at least in that initial statement, that the whole question, is it or isn't, is it acceptable or not, that the Beis Yosef, Machaber, is basically saying, yeah, it's classified as a harama, and it's an acceptable harama. That's what it sounds like. And the Rishonim, so it's noteworthy that there's a range of interpretations as to what this phrase means. Some of them very bad for us. Some of them sound bad for us, but ultimately are okay. And some of them are okay for us, so in terms of our contemporary practice. So what are the interpretations? So the one that sounds the worst for us is one that a number of Rishonim have. I gave you the Ritva to look at as one example, but a number of other Rishonim have it also, that the issue is, as long as you don't do it every year. Ooh. So that looks bad for us, right? So that's the whole problem, that we have this set into our schedule, into our calendar, that we do it every year. So here, and a number of other Rishonim do have this as well. So the good news is, this is not accepted the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch or in others. So as far as a practical implication of that condition, so you can maybe breathe easy. But what exactly is the nature, and what's the message behind that objection? So you could understand it a couple of ways. So you could say that it goes to the perception of this as essentially an evasion, and that saying it's not really the Ratzon HaTorah here, and that we're tolerating it in difficult circumstances, as Yossi pointed out, the whole picture of the boat, maybe is that supposed to paint a picture of Shasat Chak, and this is not something that should be normal. And if you're doing it again and again, so then you are essentially abusing the system. And that reflects a certain hashkafa of what the concern of Haram is. Interestingly, saw in one place in the Tshuvas L'Haris Nos, then in a different context, he quotes this ritva over here, M'sachem Adav Chaf Aleph, as saying that you can't use haramas regularly, and that would seem to understand it as essentially it's just morally not ideal because it's against the spirit of the law, it's against the Ratzon HaTorah, it's meant to be only in urgent situations, and to use it regularly is problematic for that reason. So if that's what the Ritva is getting at, so then you could extrapolate from here to other kinds of haramos. However, it could be that's not what he means. It could be that he means that somehow if you're doing it regularly, so then that calls into question the sincerity of the whole process. That, you know, when it happens once, okay, so you transfer it to him over Pesach. And then after Pesach, you say, now can I work out getting it back from you? So, okay, so maybe that was a real sale. But when, every year, this keeps happening, and you keep selling it to him, and you keep getting it back after Pesach. So he knows that, okay, this is the way it works. I'm always selling it back to you after Pesach, and maybe I have to watch it for you. So then that starts to call into question from both sides, maybe the sincerity of the sale. I'm just worried we won't finish it now. So if that's the issue, so then maybe that is specific to the Kenyan process here. It's not necessarily about haramas in general, but it's about Mechiras Chametz specifically and about the nature of the Kenyan. And it sounds like that because the Ritva writes that if one does it every year, then the Chametz becomes usur, meaning that he doesn't think the sale is valid. He thinks that it calls into question what's happening and that it's not actually sold. So I wonder if it's a valid extrapolation to say that he's talking here about an issue of the spirit of the law and gaming the system, and that you could transfer from this to other things. I think there's room to be misopic if that's what he means. But in any event, so this concern, which would certainly impact what we do nowadays if it were accepted the halacha, so at least as far as the letter of the law, at least as far as halacha, this is explicitly not what is accepted in the later Sfarim and Shulchan Aruch and the like. So there are at least two other interpretations. So one interpretation, which sounds bad for us, is that you have to actually remove the chametz from your possession. So that sounds bad for us because we generally keep the chametz in our houses, and the purchaser generally doesn't come to pick it up. But it's not as bad as it sounds because, as Mishnah Berurah writes, that we do address by transferring the area where the chametz is located and by providing access. We do that in a number of different ways, especially nowadays with keys and codes and cell phones. And we provide genuine access to the purchaser to be able to get to the chametz. So as much as that sounded like a problem, that's not necessarily a problem for us nowadays.
Where are we showing them that say that?
So the Rabbeinu Manoach and a few others. You know, look at Mishnah Berurah talks about it. So the most common approach to this, which goes to your question, which we have to discuss, the previous question we have to discuss very quickly, is that what they most understand that to mean, this idea of avad shlo yarim, is that you have to give it as a matana gemura, that you shouldn't give it al manas lahachzir, that you give it to the purchaser or to the, you give it as a gift, that if you give it to the non-Jew and say the condition is that he has to return it afterwards, that becomes a problem. Now here again, it's a question, is that a problem in an absolute sense? Would it invalidate things, or is it more of just a general kind of problem? It doesn't seem like it would actually or should actually invalidate things, because as you were indicating before, the lulav, that we say matana manas lahachzir shmei matana, that for the term of ownership, the recipient does own the item. So it's not clear why even a matana manas lahachzir should actually invalidate this in a general sense. Maybe it could be that some just saw that as too much of a game already, that if you're explicitly saying, okay, I'm guaranteeing that you will give this back to me afterwards, and I'm making the transfer contingent on your giving it back, that's already too much, and maybe it conveys now a sense of responsibility on the recipient to protect it. That's already too much as far as chametz is concerned. But whatever it is, that is pretty much accepted into practice, that is reflected in what we do, that when we transfer the chametz, we sell the chametz, we sell it absolutely, and there is no condition put into place that the purchaser or the recipient has to give the chametz back afterwards. So that seems to be satisfied, and that's the condition that is brought in Shulchan Aruch. So as far as that issue of harama, it seems like we have, as far as what's on the page, it seems that we've addressed it. So it's interesting to note is as far as the whole debate, which would really kind of burst out more a few hundred years later with the Bechor Shor and everyone who surrounded him, that it seems like the Rishonim essentially addressed the question of harama by Mechiras Hametz, and for the most part, they basically saw it as a question of the process, that the process could be a harama. It's not necessarily inherently a harama. It's a question of how you do it and how seriously you carry it out, but not that it's automatically a harama. And this is also reflected in the fact that the Rabbeinu David, for example, Umsachim and Avav, so he quotes this in the context of Bittel. He quotes this Tosefta in the context of Bittel to make the point that Bittel could be a harama also. So you have to, the Bittel is something we know, we don't question the validity of Bittel, it's a Gemara and a requirement. We know that Bittel exists, the Kuli Alma, and something that we're actually obligated to do. But he discusses that bittul could also become a harama if you don't take it seriously. So that if a person does bittul chametz and he has chametz that he knows about that's out there, so that would also be a harama. As I mentioned before, it's machlokas rishonim, whether bittul works by chametz that is known, as to Nuschos and the Rambam. And a lot of rishonim hold that bittul does work by chametz that is yadua. But even if it works technically, so one could certainly see why that's not in the spirit of the halacha. It's not what we want, that you should be mevatel chametz that you know about, and it clearly undermines the commitment to bittul. So certainly we could understand whether or not it technically works, that as far as the intent of the law, we would only want to use bittul for chametz that we don't know about, that we looked and we can't find it, and who knows, it's under the couch somewhere. But that's the chametz that we're being mevatel. So the Rebbeinu David writes that when it comes to bittul chametz, you have to make sure that it not become harama, and he makes reference to this context as well. So you see there the usage is not that the process is or isn't a harama in an objective way. It depends on how you approach it. It could be more or less of a harama. So that's how it seems to emerge from essentially all these Rishonim, the Ritva maybe the most, saying that the attitude towards using it and reusing it could make it into a harama. But even that's just a form of the question of how you relate to it rather than the question of the process itself. Now the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, you could say that he's maybe the exception in the way he asked the question in the Beis Yosef. They said, oh, the whole thing is a harama, but it's acceptable, so I don't understand the objection. So it sounds like he was classifying it as a acceptable harama, although his language maybe is a little debatable, because then he goes on to endorse essentially the opinion that he does quote in Shulchan Aruch, that you shouldn't do it al matana al manas lahachzir. It's got to be a matana gemura. So it could be that he's also grouped with the rest of the Rishonim as saying really boils down to how you do it. It's not either a harama or not. It's going to come down to how you do it. And maybe you could say that he would have said that even if you did it insincerely, it could have still been acceptable. But then ultimately what emerges here is that it has to be a more serious process. So essentially, there's a lot of debate about this and a lot more, but I'd like to just zero in on a few more points. So essentially, to reflect the idea that the concern is not so much about process with haramis in general, but that the concern is about evading the halacha, so this is consistent with an approach that Rav Shechter Shlita has in Bikve Hatzom, where he understands that the basic guiding principle as to whether we're comfortable with the harama or not, so he does not work off the assumption that it's a deraisa derabanan distinction. It's not come from that premise. But he thinks the major question is, so what area of halacha are we talking about? Are we talking about avoiding a lo saseh, or are we talking about avoiding a mitzvah saseh? And so here you see he's coming from a whole different issue. The issue is more about the assumption that there is some kind of moral responsibility, Ratzon Hashem, that you are avoiding. So in that case, there could be a distinction between a lo saseh and an aseh, that for a lo saseh, so if technically the lo saseh doesn't apply to you, okay, so then it doesn't apply, so then I'm not doing anything wrong. But if there's a mitzvah saseh, so then it means there's something inherently valuable about this action, and I technically may not be obligated in it right now, but there's something valuable in it, and if I avoid the obligation, so then I'm missing out on something that really is good to do, even though I'm technically not obligated. So maybe that's more of a moral problem. It's based on a Gemara in Menachos and Daf Mem Aleph, where the Gemara talks about Katina, who was, seems like he was going out of his way to wear garments that were not obligated in tzitzis. Big question how this would apply to us nowadays, where our normal garments would not necessarily be obligated in tzitzis. But tzitzis, the mitzvah saseh, and you would think, okay, so if you're not obligated, you're not obligated. But it sounds like from that Gemara that he was taking efforts to make sure he was wearing things that wouldn't be obligated. And the Malach gave him a hard time about this. And he said, well, it's a mitzvah saseh. There's no onesh for avoiding mitzvah saseh. And we usually mean that, as Tosfos clarifies over there, we mean that even when there's a clear obligation on the aseh. So let's say somebody's wearing dalet kanfes without tzitzis. That's called a bitul aseh in the active sense. But we still don't assume that's an onesh, or there's an onesh involved. But if somebody eats inside or in sukkahs, doesn't eat in the sukkah, so he eats food that's not in the sukkah, so that's a bitul aseh in the active sense, but we still assume there's no onesh for that, it's not a lav. But here the Gemara raises this issue, is it shayachi to be punished for a bitul aseh? And Tosfos emphasizes here we're talking about not like eating outside the sukkah or wearing dalet kanfes, we're talking about just avoiding the chiyuv in the first place. We are not subject to the aseh. And could there be an onesh? So the Gemara says, yeah, there's a lot to discuss about how much this applies in practice. But the Gemara says, yes, that in a situation, in a moment of anger, God may punish even for an aseh, that God may take out his anger on somebody who avoids a mitzvah aseh in the way that's described in the Gemara. So essentially, this is the approach that Rav Shechter writes about, that somebody who seeks to avoid an aseh is more problematic than somebody who is simply orchestrating things that he's not subject to a lo saseh. And that could influence a lot of things. So Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, has a tshuva about haramos in one of his volumes of Menachos Asher, where he takes, you know, a similar approach. He goes through all the examples. He doesn't say exactly like that, but, you know, he's somebody who's written extensively about the notion of Ratzon HaTorah and other places, and he essentially says, he thinks by lo saseh also it's theoretically possible one could be avoiding the Ratzon HaTorah, but certainly when it comes to an aseh, so he essentially endorses that position. So for that reason, for that general approach, in slightly different ways, so both of them write that there are, you think you can understand why we are okay with Mechiras Chametz. So the way Rav Shechter formulates it, he says that when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, so we have aseis and los aseis involved. So as far as Bayiran and Bayimatze, those are los aseis. So to orchestrate things so that you're not subject to Bal Yirah, Bal Yimatzeh, so that should be okay. That shouldn't be a violation of this Yisod. Now, what if you say there's an Aseh of Tashbisu? So there's a lot of lumdas to get involved in terms of whether there is an active mitzvah of Tashbisu or whether it's just there to endorse and to strengthen the Los Aseis. So that's where there's a difference. So Rav Asher Weiss in his Tshuvas, he basically understands like that, that you shouldn't see Tashbisu as an Aseh, like wearing tzitzis, that Tashbisu is essentially there to strengthen Bal Yirah, Bal Yimatzeh. So therefore, philosophically, we're dealing with Los Aseis here. So if one is avoiding the Los Aseis, so that's essentially how we would look at it, and it would be in that kind of a category. But the way Rav Schechter articulates it is a little different. He says that, yes, maybe there is an active value of Tashbisu, but that doesn't apply to every morsel of chametz that one ever owned. So everyone does a shtickle tashbisu. Everyone gets rid of at least a little chametz. So the mitzvah aseh we're not avoiding completely, and it doesn't make sense, he thinks, to say that the aseh meant that every chametz you've ever owned you should actively be destroying. So maybe there is some value in actively destroying some chametz, and if you also have other chametz that you arrange that you're not subject to those aseh, that would not be a thwarting of the Ratzon HaTorah. So that's one approach. I'd like to just supplement that approach in the next few minutes. So first of all, you all heard me mention on Shabbos, I think there's an additional reason to say that we're not thwarting the intent of the Torah. That, first of all, we don't really have any indication from the Torah itself that there's any problem with coming back to the chametz after Pesach. That it certainly seems that the issue is not owning the chametz during Pesach specifically. And we discussed that the position of the Ran and many others is that the issue of owning chametz on Pesach is that we may come to eat the chametz on Pesach. And we suggested that, therefore, if that's the main issue, so even just formally transferring title to somebody else hopefully should be effective in keeping us from eating chametz on Pesach, because if we're makbid on gezela, so then that should keep us away from touching somebody else's chametz. So if we're careful with property rights and we're careful not to take somebody else's things, so then that will have that same effect. Maybe that is a fulfillment of the Ratzon HaTorah, that we shouldn't come to violate the Isser of eating chametz. So maybe it's possible to argue, and tomorrow when we compare it to Hetz Mechira, we'll get into a little bit more detail about this, but maybe it's possible to argue if we look at it through this prism of, it's a subjective prism, but just how different are we from the intent of the Torah and what we're doing, that maybe Mechiras Chametz is not so far from the intent of the Torah, and maybe that's why we are comfortable with it, but it also is going to make a difference how we reflect that in our actions. So we have to be honest all the time and be careful about gezeila all the time, but also regarding the sale, to really see it as an absolute sale and really see it as meaning that we cannot touch this chametz, cannot eat this chametz, cannot use this chametz, and we don't just assume, well, he's machal on this, he's machal on that, it's okay. But that we really take it very seriously and assume that the chametz is genuinely in the bialis of somebody else and that we are completely respectful of that. So with that, I'd like to just also add, I don't know how far you got in Makoros today, but a very interesting discussion, which I think also supports this notion that there is an assessment one could make about the Ratzon HaTorah and the intent of the law, and just how much that affects how comfortable we are with what may or may not be termed as a harama. So there is a very mysterious passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is a big part of the literature about this, and it's very mysterious. So, for example, the literature surrounding the Bechor Shor, so there's a whole history. The grandson of the Bechor Shor was the Beis Ephraim, Ephraim Zalman Margolius, and he wrote very extensively to defend the position of his grandfather. He wrote this in his Tshuvas Beis Ephraim, and he also wrote a separate sefer called Kono Makne, where he writes Barichus, why he thinks his position is correct. He was very defensive of his grandfather's positions, Kibud Zakeno. It's actually interesting that the Balatanya, so his grandson was the Tzemach Tzedek. Tzemach Tzedek wrote that my grandfather Balatanya in the Shulchan Aruch Harav, he wrote the same thing as the Bechor Shor, that it doesn't work on a Deraisa, but he thinks it's wrong. He thinks it's against Gemara, so he didn't take the same filial obligation of defending his grandfather's position, but the Beis Ephraim certainly did, and he wrote about this extensively. So Chassam Sofer has a tshuva, has a few tshuvas, where he defends Mechiras Chametz. It's in Siman Samach Beis in Aruch Chaim, in Siman Kufid Gimel, in Orosol and Yeridei, in Siman Shin Chof. He has a number of tshuvas where he supports Mechiras Hametz, and he doesn't think it's a harama, and he doesn't think haramas are so bad, because the whole circular point is the whole thing about it, and he doesn't think that there's a distinction between deraisas and derabanans either. So a big part of the literature is a very mysterious Yerushalmi, which I'll try to explain the time that we have, what I think may be the pshat in the Yerushalmi, is that there is a Mishnah in Maaser Sheni, in the fourth parak of Maaser Sheni, which talks about Marimin al Maaser Sheni. There's a way to be Marim in the context of Maaser Sheni. I'll have a Chumash here, because I'll open up a Chumash here also. If you have access to a Chumash, it would be helpful to see this inside. I put the Pesukim on the list this morning. This is actually from the Laning in the last day of Yontif. When it's Shabbos, from Aser Taser. So from Parshas Re'eh. So the Mishnah says that when it comes to Maaser Sheni, you can be Mayrim. And what does that mean? It means that normally, if you can't bring, or if you don't want to bring all the payros to your Shalayim, so then you have to be poded. You have to redeem it onto money. And when you redeem it onto money, you have to pay a chomesh. You have to pay an extra percentage on top of that. So that could be expensive. So the Mishnah says that because the din is, you only have to pay the chomesh if you're redeeming your own Maaser Sheni. So you can ask somebody else, let's say an adult child who has his own identity now, you can ask an adult child to redeem it on your behalf, and you can give him money and say, okay, here's money, take this money, and redeem the Maaser Sheni. And that way, he won't have to pay the chomesh because he's doing somebody else's Maaser Sheni, and that will get you around it. So Mayrim Maaser Sheni. So the Yerushalmi there says, what's going on? How can you Mayrim Maaser Sheni? How can the Gemara is talking about, the Mishnah is talking about being Mayrim? So it says, because Kasuv Bo Bracha. So it's a reference to the Pasuk here. Ki Varecha Hashem Elokecha. So very, very mysterious. And what's going on there? So there's a whole debate, Nechsem Sofer, there's a lot about this in that tshuva. So some say, okay, that Yerushalmi is a proof that normally here you're dealing with a Din D'oraisa, Maaser Sheni's Din D'oraisa, and here you have a Harama, so what's going on? So some say, well, this is proof that you can only do it by D'oraisas because Yerushalmi has to explain it. So, oh, because it's a bracha, that's why it's okay. And the Sam Sofer writes, no, that because it's a bracha, and he has a complicated explanation why, he says, so therefore, Chazal were actually recommending you do a harama. They say you should do it. But for everything else, it's still mutter, even by their ices, and this is an exception in the other direction. So there's a lot of literature. It's very complex. So just to say quickly what I think Pshat here is that what's going on is that Maaser Sheni, first of all, we're not talking about being Mayrim on the Maaser Sheni itself, we're talking about being Mayrim on the Chomesh, being Mayrim on the extra percentage that you put on to be Podet. And I think what's being reflected here is that, yes, it's true, like Rosh Hashanah writes, that we don't want to avoid an actual responsibility. If you have a mitzvah saseh, something that really is the Ratzon HaTorah that we should all be doing, so it would be wrong to try to avoid that. But what are we talking about here? We're not talking about Maaser Sheni itself. And we're not talking about even being poded. We're talking about the detail of being poded, a consequence, so to speak, that comes along with being poded. So let's say, let's posit, this is a little bit arguable, but let's posit that really the L'chachila Ratzon HaTorah is that you'll bring the peros to your Yerushalayim. Secondary, if you're not able to do that, or you don't want to do that, you're not able to do that, so then you should be poded. But if the ideal is you should really bring the payers to Yerushalayim, so we don't want people to be poded necessarily, so we want to put a little tax on it. Economic disincentive is why taxes work. So if you have to pay extra, you're less likely to do that. That may or may not be the reason. It's a little bit arguable, but let's posit that for a second. That's the idea. However, now let's posit the following. But let's say somebody, Mamish, just has so many payers that it's just literally impossible for him to get them all to Yerushalayim. And he lives too far away, and it's too much. There's no way he's getting all these payers to Yerushalayim. So now, do we really want to disincentivize this guy to be poda? It's not fair. He essentially, this is a bracha with Kadosh Baruch Hu, gave him all these payers, and now he's stuck. And even if you don't subscribe to the idea that it's a disincentive, but Lamaisa, he is disincentivized because maybe he can't even afford the chomesh, and it's literally impossible for him to get the payers to Yerushalayim. And the whole point was that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to bless him. There's a language of bracha here. So if you look at the Pesukim, I think it's meduyuk there. That's what's going on. So the Pesuk says, just to read quickly, right, so if you have it open in front of you, so Pasuk Chav Beis, right, Aser Ta'aser is called Tfuaz Darecha, Hayotze Asada, Shana Oshana. Next Pasuk, V'achalt Lefnei Hashem Elokecha, Makom HaShiyivcha, L'shakin Shmo Shom. So it sounds like, L'chachila, you should be eating it in Yerushalayim. That's what the Torah is really saying. Right, so it goes on to say, you should take the parish. That sounds like the ideal. Next pasuk, okay, but that doesn't work. Maybe. But let's say you can't. It's too much. You can't schlep it all to Yerushalayim. It's too far. You can't bring it there. Why? Because God has blessed you. Right, so God has blessed you, and Rashi says, what does this mean, kivarechacha? So Rashi explains, what's the bracha? Shetehei ha-tavua merubu l'seis. God blessed you so much that you can't carry all these peros. So as a function of God's blessing, you're not able to catch it. So you're not able to carry it. So I think this is pretty much meduyik in what's going on, that the Torah is painting a picture here and saying that, yes, by default, somebody wants to be poda his Meister Sheini, he should have to pay a little bit extra, whether it's a disincentive or whether it's just a factor for other reasons, but the Meister, yes, by default, that's the din. But you could also have the scenario where the Torah is saying God is intending to bless you, and he gave you so many payers, but that blessing could end up getting messed up because either it's not fair to disincentivize you because of the bracha, which her used the language is impossible for you to carry, lo suchol say so, or whether or not it's meant to be a disincentive, but in practice, you may not be able to do it, and that for sure will undermine the bracha. That for sure is going to undermine the express Ratzon HaTorah. So one could argue this Yerushalmi is essentially an endorsement to this whole point, that when are we comfortable with a harama? So when you have a situation where the Ratzon HaTorah is not necessarily impacted negatively by the Rama, and maybe in fact it's improved, so then, maybe that's a reason to take a different approach. Maybe that's essentially the message of the Yerushalmi, especially by emphasizing the Kasa B'Lashon Bracha, that the Bracha that comes from that Pasuk is saying that because this is meant to be good for you, and here the Chomesh is going to either be not called for, or maybe even undermine the bracha that this is supposed to be. So in this kind of a situation, we'll recommend, the harama will recommend getting around it. And that seems to be the thrust of it. So that's also a part of the whole picture. Now, we're not arguing when it comes to Mechiras Chametz that it goes that far, because we're not arguing necessarily that it's as compelling a case as this guy who literally can't get his payers to Shalim that was supposed to be a bracha, and now he's stuck. This is maybe a more compelling case. But the idea that there's a correlation between how much we accept the harama and how much it detracts or doesn't detract or helps in some other way the Ratzon HaTorah, I think that maybe does emerge from this Yerushalmi. So the extent to which we can bring our activities more in concert with the Ratzon HaTorah, the more comfortably we will be. Now, how does that impact on the Het Mechira? So Bez Hashem, we'll try to see that tomorrow. You all have a wonderful day. Should be only good things.